I didn't even realize I was wasting $415 a month until I downloaded Rocket Money. I thought I had my finances under control until the app laid out all my spending and categorized it for me. Takeout, shopping, and unused subscriptions were quietly draining my account. And as a result, my savings took a back seat. But Rocket Money doesn't just tell you what you're wasting money on. It takes action to save you money. First, the app looks at your income and monthly expenses and calculates how much you can safely spend each day to stay under budget. Rocket Money also finds and cancels unwanted subscriptions for you and even negotiates better rates on your bills so you have more money in your pocket. On average, Rocket Money members can save up to $740 a year when using all the app's premium features. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. It's time to simplify your finances and take control of your money. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Hey guys, welcome to Maker Stories. As the name suggests, it is all about stories of makers, wherein in each episode, I will get into casual conversation with makers. And we talk about how they work, how they live, and what motivates them. In this episode, I have Raghunandan as my guest. Raghunandan is a railway locomotive model maker and a former joint secretary for the Government of India. Listen to know more about the history of Indian railway locomotive, some of the models that he has built, and how he uses Sherlock Holmes reduction theory to identify a particular model. So let's get started. Hi Raghunandan, welcome to Maker Story.
Thank you, it's a pleasure to be here.
So as a ritual of this Maker Story podcast, everyone introduce themselves and share their story. So why don't you go ahead and share your story?
Well, it's difficult to describe what I do. I used to be in the government. I worked as an IAS officer for 27 years. Then I quit the government in 2010. And since then, I've been following my profession as a consultant on governance and anti-corruption. And I work across the world and in India also on issues relating to corruption and local government. But primarily, I'm passionate about making models. And that's an old passion. I started when I was a child. And I've managed to hang on to this passion through all these years of professional life. I'm actually getting into a kind of a situation where I hope to take off and increase the frequency of my model making, spend more time on it. Well, my first models were made when I was a child, maybe about 8 or 10 years old. My father was a bit strict. I mean, he wouldn't buy me too many toys. And I had a passion for cars. And I used to look at all those tin plate cars. You know, those days, there were these toys were made of tin plate. And I always envied children who had tin plate cars. So I tried to make some of those in cardboard using waste cardboard, old notebook covers and so on and so forth. Basically, not running models, but stationary models. Then I remember I got a mechano set and I got my first motor at the age of 11 years. And that was a great thing because with a motor, you could put things and you could, you know, get things to work and run. But most often what used to happen was I used to spend all the battery power testing the motor. And finally, when I made vehicles which were to run, then there wasn't enough battery power to pull the vehicles, and I had to go and beg my parents to buy batteries. So I've been building models since childhood, since the age of 8 or 10, and I continue to do so now.
So even during your childhood, your passion was mostly around building railway locomotives, or you were building something else as well?
No, actually, those days, see, locomotives are complex. So essentially, I was building a lot of car models. I mean, I was essentially using things like old ice cream spoons, milk bottle caps, extremely crude. I mean, you laugh if you see some of those. Unfortunately, no pictures of that remain. But I was very fond of these large American cars, you know, Impalas and Chevrolets and all that. And I tried to replicate that in cardboard. Very crudely, I would draw draw the windows out, cut it out, and so on and so forth. They were not running vehicles. They were just models, very rough models. So I would do all that. I would use a lot of cigarette paper, I remember, because that was a way to replicate chrome. So I would use a lot of cigarette paper to cover the mud guards. And what happens is when you start making models as a child is you start looking at waste material and you start, every waste material is useful. So whatever people throw out, I used to collect and hold it, which I still do, which is a big problem now. But I still collect stuff and keep it, hoping that it will be useful at some day.
All right. So how and when did you get interested in building railway locomotives?
I've always been interested in railway locomotives. No doubt about it. That's an old story. You see, my family, I belong to Kerala, and my father's village is located in a district called Palakkad. And one of the first railway lines towards in the south was built from Madras to a place called Shorenur, which is in Palakkad district. And from Shorenur, a line was built northward towards Mangalore. Because those days, you must remember that Mangalore was part of Madras Presidency. Mm-hmm. And the only way to get from the coast, from the eastern coast to the western coast, was along the Palghat Pass. Because otherwise, you could not cross the Western Ghats without building tunnels. So it was a bit of a convoluted route because the trains would come down to Coimbatore, pass through the gap in the Western Ghats called the Palghat Pass, come into Kerala and then go northward all the way up to Mangalore. So when that line was built, my family's ancestral home was demolished because it came exactly in the path of the railway line. So my great-grandfather had to build a new house, he built in 1887 or 1888. In fact, that ancestral house, it's now 130 years old. It's still with the family. Wow. So that was built about 500 meters away from the main railway line. So that railway line used to go past my house. And I always remember this in my childhood. I mean, we didn't have electricity in the village those days. So when I used to go for my summer holidays to the village, it would turn dark and we had nothing much to do. But all through, we would hear these trains going past, Beautiful, lovely steam engines, and we could recognize which train was passing. Like if the Cochin Express was passing, we knew it was a Cochin Express. And goods trains, and it was not that the railway line was not very close, but you could see the trains from home. And there's always been this air of mystery and romance about railway locomotives as far as I was concerned. And during the afternoons, my parents would force me to sleep because there's no electricity and there's no fans. It would be very hot. But I would sneak away and go and stand near the railway line and wave out to the guards and the driver and all that. So I had really fond memories of childhood and railway locomotives. I always loved them. Even today, if I see a steam locomotive, something happens, if I see a steam locomotive in a movie or it just calms me and it makes me very, very emotional, if I may say so, just watching a steam locomotive. Mm-hmm. And even today when I feel very tense, I keep watching steam locomotive videos on YouTube and it calms me down. It's like meditation or something. I love watching steam locomotives. So I was always interested in locomotives. Mm-hmm. I'm not a science student. I mean, I'm a science student, but I didn't do engineering or anything like that. I did biology and then law. And that was the situation. So it's an old passion. I mean, railway locomotives have always been an old passion.
So what is the typical procedure of building one model? And exactly how do you start?
See, it depends, it depends upon, see, first of all, model making is a very fascinating thing and it offers wide flexibility for a wide range of skills to be used, right? So it depends. Now, there are some people who build models out of kits and you can buy plastic kits, you can buy epoxy kits, you can buy metal kits. And while some people might look down upon making kits and by saying that it's a shortcut, I can tell you that some of the kits which are like 200, 300 $6 or so are extremely difficult to build. I mean, there's a company called Poker. Poker manufactures 1/8 scale limited edition models of cars. Each Poker kit, you know, will take at least a year to manufacture, to make. I mean, it's really expensive. You have to make each wheel. So kits, plastic, epoxy and metal kits are available, which you can finish. Various complexity levels are there. But what I do is, I have always been interested in scratch building. That is, building from scratch. And not many people actually build from scratch. Now, you might ask me, why do I build from scratch? Now, I build from scratch because I can really create something that is unique. You can take a model and you can modify it, and you can take a kit and modify it and make it unique. But with the scratch building, you can actually, there's no limit on what you can build. Mm-hmm. The thing about me is that I build all my models, I mean, I stick to Indian themes. So when I stick to Indian themes and Indian, locomotives and cars, there are no kits available also. You just have to build from scratch. There's no option. So both things have forced me to build scratch. I like the challenge of scratch building. Plus, the fact is that whatever I build of Indian locomotives is completely unique because there are no model kits anyway. So when you ask me what is the typical process of building one model, I start with the research for the model. Let me tell you that research on the model in this day and age is about 40% of the work on the model. When I say research, it means taking photographs of the model, and of the prototype, and measuring the prototype, or trying to get blueprints of the prototype. So a lot of research goes into the locomotives. Then once I take the collect all my data, which is essentially pictures of the locomotive, blueprint if it is available, or actual measurements from a prototype. These days, what I do is I convert it into CAD. Earlier, I never used to convert into CAD. I used to make drawings by hand. I mean, I used to calculate the proportions and make the drawings by hand. But these days, I do a lot of it in CAD. In fact, I do all of it in CAD. It has really speeded up my process, and it enables me to make very complex, models. So once you get the things out in CAD, then it depends on the material. So far, I have not gone in for 3D printing or metal models. I've been using cardboard. And when I make models in cardboard, I cut out in laser cut the cardboard pieces, and then I laminate it to the appropriate thickness. So it's a little complex in the sense that I have to imagine each part as a laminated part. And so if I've got to get a particular profile, I have to make multiple patterns so that when all the pieces are assembled together, it looks like the part that I want to make. Like, for example, a wheel will consist of maybe 11 to 13 laminates of cardboard, I mean, patterns of cardboard. And each pattern will vary from the other pattern, because when I stick it together, I get the curvature of the spokes and so on and so forth. So it's 3D printing would have been very easy, because if I had a 3D model, I would have just got it 3D printed. Mm-hmm. But it's challenging and interesting to do it this way. But it takes too long, and I will be proceeding to make metal and epoxy models where the techniques will be somewhat different. But typically when you build a model, as I said, get the drawings, depending upon the material, either do it by lamination or by 3D printing. And broadly speaking, I build the boring parts first. See, enthusiasm is very high when you start the model.
Correct.
So when enthusiasm is high, you should do the boring stuff. So that when your enthusiasm comes down, you can do the interesting stuff that will keep your enthusiasm going. So I start from below. I start with the wheels. I start with the chassis. And I build upwards and outwards. That is, I do the things that are concealed first. and then keep on building outwards. So I might do the chassis first, then do some of the parts inside or in between the chassis, which we cannot even see when it's outside. Then I fit the axles, then I fit the wheels, then I fit the running gear, I fit the cylinders, then I put the boiler. So it goes out from below, it goes outwards and upwards. That's how I do it.
Yeah. That's quite interesting actually. So if we talk about the numbers, so how many models have you built so far?
Actually, that's the problem. I mean, my earlier models, which I built as a child and all, are gone. Mm-hmm. I must not have built more than 8 or 10 models totally. Scratch built. Mm-hmm. Kit built, I have built, because I also do kits. Kits are easy. I mean, 1 week you can finish a kit. If I look at scratch built models that are of exhibition quality, I am finishing only my second model right now. I've got one model of the Darjeeling Himalayan Railway B-class locomotive. Which has been written about it. You'll find it on the internet and all that. The other is that I have made I am in the process of making a YG locomotive. And this has taken me 4 years. It may take me another about 3 to 4 months to finish it.
Wow.
The parts are finished. Yeah, because of course, it's also because, you know, professionally I have other work. So this is like a part-time relaxation and so on and so forth. It's not that every day I sit and work. Mm-hmm. But it has taken me 4 years because it's a slow process. It's a really slow process. So when I do it in cardboard, it takes a little, extra time.
All right. Talking about the technology, how do you leverage various technology while building your model?
Yeah, now that's an interesting thing. See, so far the technology that I've used is I use CAD and I use laser cutting at present. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
But I am in the process of rejigging my process because, you know, if I make one model in 4 years, in the next 10-20 years, I'll make only 5 models. Right? Mm-hmm. So I am looking at it this way. I'm saying instead of making one model in 4 years, I make 4 models in 1 year. So if I have to make 4 models in 1 year, which is possible, it's possible, then I need to automate. I need to get into other material. Cardboard is too slow a material to make because lamination and putting the pins and that and this and putting all the detail takes a hell of a long time. Mm-hmm. So right now, my process that I'm looking at is as follows. For all the planar parts in a locomotive, that is essentially all the flat parts, like the chassis frame, like the running gear, etc. What I plan to do is I'll be doing laser cutting and I will be I'll be doing a bit of milling. For that, I've got a CNC mill. I am not very proficient at using connecting CAD to the CNC mill. I have to do a little bit of Mach 3 exploration and I have to do that. So essentially what I will be doing for the planar parts is 2D drawings on CAD, using it for laser cutting of aluminium and steel. That's one part. And then you doing milling, CNC milling, using a Proxon mill that I've converted to CNC and using 3D CAD drawings for that, which I have to learn how to do it. I'm actually working on that at the moment. Then when you come to things like wheels, now here I'm faced with two choices. One is that I can mill out the wheel from a solid billet of metal. That's one way of looking at it. Mm-hmm. So then what happens is I just put it into the mill, into the CNC mill, and the CNC mill keeps running and it clears out all the metal. So I can let it work overnight and by morning I'll have a wheel. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that I only have a 3-axis CNC machine. And 4-axis machines are extremely expensive, $4,000 to $5,000. Mm-hmm. And I think it just takes away the fun of doing 4-axis. So one thing is to do it that way. The other way is to do a 3D print in some kind of ABS type of plastic, finish it perfectly, and do lost wax casting. And because if I do lost wax casting, I can make it in brass and gunmetal and all that, which is a different, you know, it gives a different look altogether. You know, I've been to England and I've seen some of the models made in the 1860s and 1850s. Mm-hmm. And you have to marvel at the quality of that finish. In those days, using the machinery 150 years back, the kind of quality, every single nut and bolt can be seen on that. Absolute craftsmanship, no? So I feel that too much of technology is actually, we are cheating, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, we cannot compare ourselves with the craftspeople of the past because we are cheating, and anybody can do it. A person with average skills and good CAD skills and the understanding of sequencing can do it. So then it takes away the fun. At the end of the day, I'm an artist. Mm-hmm. And I want to do something with my hand only. So I will mix and match. I may get the pattern made through 3D printing, but I'll finish it by hand. And I hope to get it cast using lost wax casting. And lost wax casting is a 3,000, 4,000 year old technology. So it's a mixing of traditional technology with current technology. Because at the end of the day, there has to be a challenge, no? It's not just about, because some people come and tell me, oh, you just 3D print the whole thing in ABS. Then I say, well, what's the difference? I mean, I might as well make it, buy a kit. No, so it's, for me, I'm not into commercial production. Of course, I want to speed up. And for speeding up, I will use technology. Mm-hmm. Right? But at the end of the day, there's still the beauty of doing something by hand. I mean, if you go to Switzerland, and I used to teach in Switzerland, so I used to go there. And if you see the watchmaking industry, almost all of it is a cottage industry. And you see it to believe it, the kind of tools that they use, the kind of quality they achieve by handwork, you know. And end of the day, I'm a craftsman. I'd like to improve my craftsmanship skills.
Yep. Yeah. You mentioned about challenges. So what were some of the challenges?
See, basic challenge is that India's documentation on its locomotives is abysmally bad. It's really bad. Mm-hmm. Let me give you a bit of history of this. The first locomotives came to India in 1853. Now, from 1853 to around 1903, that's almost 50 years, there was no standardization of Indian locomotives. There were no standard classes. You know, we used to buy locomotives from all over the world. We used to buy British locomotives. We used to buy, you know, locomotives from Germany, few of them. We used to buy Swiss locomotives and so on and so forth. Now, what used to happen was that there were all so many private companies and they were maintaining so many different kinds of locomotives. There was no standardization. I mean, India doesn't maintain any drawings. So you have to measure those locomotives. See, for example, Darjeeling is somewhat better because Darjeeling drawings are available also because there's a big enthusiast following for Darjeeling. But if I wanted to make a narrow gauge locomotive that ran in Baroda, I have to go and measure it. And measuring a locomotive is not for everybody. I mean, I like it, I do it, and I've gained through experience about what to measure, how to take, how to compare photographs with measurements, how to do. There's a very complex process. And I learned it from a book written by a master craftsman called Gerard Wingrove, because he also used to measure cars and make scratch built models. He's a real guru. And he's written a book about the techniques of measurement. So I would follow it, but I have devised my own style of measuring, my own techniques of measuring. It's all quite complex and I have to someday document it myself. But I can measure a locomotive in about 1 week. 1 week to 10 days, I can measure a locomotive. I work from morning to evening. So no drawings are available. Then what happened was India, in 1903, we came up with the BESA standard. British Parliament passed a law and said that there was something called the BESA standard, British Engineering Standards Association or something like that. So then what happened was that locomotives began to be standardized in classes, which means that, you know, you could actually interchange parts between locomotives and so on and so forth. So the BESA standard ran from 1903 to 1928. Then from 1928, we started 1922 or 28, something like that. We started something called IRS standard. That is, the Indian Railway standards were done and the standards were maintained and prepared by a institution called the RDSO, Railway Designs and Standards Organization. This is located in Lucknow. Now I contacted them. The director was very helpful, but they don't have a single drawing. I mean, this is the Indian Railways used to prepare the drawings and it used to be put out for international tender. And this organization does not have a single drawing of steam locomotives. So you tell me what's the historical ability of India to preserve its history. It's zero, right? So then what do? This is when you start traveling. You have to go abroad. You have to go to the UK. You have to go to America. I have not yet been to American museums. But UK museums, yes, I have been. And UK also, they don't put out all their details on the internet. But somehow I searched, I found out it's a detective work. You have to go there, you have to sit in the museums, you have to talk to the librarian of the archives, you pull out the documentation, and then it's like looking through hundreds and thousands of drawings, and you may find some gold dust. And sometimes you'll find a diamond. You will find the drawing. So like that, I have spent 5 weeks in England last year, and I did quite a comprehensive study in about 4 museums and archives and collected a whole lot of drawings. So but the biggest challenge as far as I am concerned is actually obtaining the baseline data to do the research, which unfortunately in India we just don't have. And another thing about India is, we had 10,000 locomotives. I think in 1996 or 97, we had 10,000 locomotives. Mm-hmm. Today, we have about 200 steam locomotives, people say. Mm-hmm. Many of the steam locomotive classes, you only have photographs. You don't even have a single prototype to measure. So I know where all the locomotives are kept in India. They are in different museums. Some of them are put in front of railway stations. Some are in private ownership. Right. So these locomotives, I can go there and measure. If the owner allows me to measure, I can measure. Railways have not been, they have been quite helpful in the sense that sometimes they ask me, aap kyun kar rahe hain, and all that when I go and measure. But then if I explain to them that I'm making a model, all the museums, they have no problem. Mm-hmm. They allow me to measure the locomotive. There's no problem about it. So I can do the measurements. But even if I do the measurements, there are many locomotive classes which are just not, they're not preserved. Even one example is not preserved. Mm-hmm. So those you have to rely upon only contemporary photographs and look at the drawing and blueprints if it's possible. That's the challenge.
Wow, this is something different. The kind of work that you do and the kind of challenges that you face is different than most of the Indian maker community. So talking about Indian maker community, what are your views on Indian maker culture?
See, I don't know much about it, but let me tell you what I have seen makes me very excited. Mm-hmm. I mean, my friend Paul D'Souza, who we have already interviewed, mm-hmm. he and I went, we had applied for a mini maker fair. We just applied, he applied, he told me to apply. And both of us got picked up for displaying our products there. And I think I was the only guy who was actually not doing something that is an electronic gizmo, mm-hmm. I was essentially making a model, and people are asking me, what use is it? Does it run? So I said, no, this is only a thing of beauty. And some people got it, some people didn't get it. But what I want to say is that the culture is really good in the sense that you meet number of people from wide backgrounds. Not everybody is a professional. Lot of amateurs are there. And when you start mixing with people who are not from the same background, who are not from the same educational background, they do something else. And you make your mind is stimulated. You learn so many new things. My only, observation that I would like to make is, A, there are not enough people. Mm-hmm. There are not enough people in the maker space. I mean, I feel very bad when I see an engineer who can't even change a tire of a car. Our engineering courses only make people into engineering clerks. Mm-hmm. Very few people in an engineering course really know how to operate a lathe, how to do machine tools. And I don't think many of them go onto the shop floor also. After doing engineering, they do a management course and they never bother about engineering after that. Our engineering courses should be much more hands-on. Of course, I still see, it's not that I'm not saying that it's bad, but there should be a lot more engineering capability in our engineers, which I don't see. I don't see that interest in many engineers with doing things with their hands. So one thing is that we need more and more people to come into the maker community. The second shortfall is, you know, it's very sad that you have a lot of enormously talented people in India with doing a lot of maker stuff. Tell me how many Indian videos you will get. If you want to learn any new skill, you go and click, and if you do a Google search on YouTube, all you get is American videos. Now it's fine. I mean, those guys explain well, whatever it is. But say you want to buy materials for doing photo etching, let's say. Mm-hmm. Now I want to know where I can buy these materials in India. So I can see there are any number of tutorials on photo etching that you'll find abroad. It will say, get this product from here and there, and get up. All the addresses are from the US or from the UK or wherever. Right. Now I also restore old vintage cars. Now for vintage cars, again, I mean, there used to be a big community. Now almost all older people have all gone and younger people are not that interested. So when I do all my vintage cars, now I do them all more or less by myself. Again, the same thing is when I want to learn something about this, all that I've got to do is I go and check out videos on YouTube, and they're all about America and UK. So we don't document and put out stuff about how to make things in India. Not as much as I want. So I also miss the bus. I mean, I am, as a maker, I should also document it properly, but I haven't taken any videos, I must confess. So I am saying that next time when I make a model and when I build it from scratch, I am going to record videos and put it up so that people know that this is the technique that I'm using. I don't want to keep any technique secret. That way, you know, if we share, we can build a nice maker culture. I think the potential is enormous. We should be having many more maker clubs, many more make spaces, and we can really, you know, change the world. I mean, in the sense that, you know, the ability to invent. I'm not an inventor, right? I'm basically doing this for my pleasure. But when I see people like Paul, or when I see that girl who's just a young teenager, you know, doing something like this, I think, wow, I mean, imagine what you could do. For example, I recently saw on the web a four-axis milling machine. Now that it's made in America, somebody's crowdsourcing the money to manufacture it. It's fantastic. But come on, don't tell me we could not have made something like that in India. We have got fantastic skills in India. And I wish I could buy it in India. Now, I cannot afford to buy it from the US because I'll have to pay heavy duty on that. It's a very delicate piece of equipment. But this is what makes you like feel that the potential is not fully utilized. I mean, people should be, we need more and more people coming into this space.
All right. So now you talked about how you build models. What were some of the challenges? You shared your views on Indian maker culture. So now coming to the personal part, what's your typical day looks like?
You know, I actually alternate between my model making and my personal hobbies and interests and my professional work. And the two don't have any connection. Professionally, as I said, I do work in the local government space, in fiscal decentralization, in governance, and so on and so forth, which is a lot of writing and typing and calls and so on and so forth. And I do a lot of international consultancy, which means that in a year, I must be traveling between 150 to 200 days, usually. Mm-hmm. So when I'm not at home, when I'm professionally busy, I'm out there working. But typically what I do is that I carry along my drawings and stuff like that, and some of the tools that I use. For example, I do a lot of my drafting, a lot of my CAD work, I do even when I'm traveling on work in the evenings, you know, after finishing my work, I do it. So typically if I'm traveling, my suitcase will contain my set of, you know, measuring instruments. I carry a binocular magnifying glass, which I wear, and I carry some powerful lights. And of course, my laptop has got all the CAD requirements. So in the evenings, I sit and I can do all these measuring. And that's one thing in my bag. I always keep a measuring tape and I keep a scale and a magnifying glass. Because suppose I suddenly see a locomotive somewhere and if I have to take a measurement or something, I can immediately take a tape or I hold a tape next to it and take a photograph so that I can keep this reference in my mind. You know, so that's when I'm traveling. If I'm in Bangalore, if I'm staying at home, I push a 16-hour day. I get up early in the morning. Every morning I make a pilgrimage. You can call it a morning walk or a pilgrimage. But I go on the pilgrimage to my friend Paul D'Souza's house. He lives about 3 kilometers away from my place. So I walk there and we sit down. He's got a beautiful 150-year-old bungalow, one of the few bungalows remaining in Whitefield. So sitting there, it's like the outside world does not exist. And every day we discuss some new ideas. He's also a maker. We share ideas. We share our mistakes. We laugh at ourselves. It's a non-serious time. We make fun of each other. But some good ideas come out. If I have a problem the previous evening, I carry it to him. He solves it and so on. So we'll sit and chat and I have a chai and some breakfast or something. We feed the squirrels and all that. And then I come back. Now when I come back, what I normally do is I finish off my emails in the morning and then I get into the workshop unless if I have a Skype call or something like that. And I alternate between model making. I do a lot of carpentry at home, model making, and the restoration of my cars. So my principle is to have different desks for different things. So what happens is if I stick something with, and the adhesive has to, you know, stick, that means I cannot work on that project. I move to the next project. If paint is drying in the car, I go back to my model and do something. And this continues. Sometimes in the afternoon, I again take a break to check my emails and send out my, you know, reports and stuff like that. And my wife works, so she comes back only by about 8 o'clock at night. So till 8, I sit and work. I try not to bring my work down into the dining table. I have a separate room where I do the model work, but sometimes things land up on the dining table. So every 6 months or so, my wife and I have a huge fight. And then all the things are cleaned up and everything goes back into the original position. But she's also a pretty talented person. She does a lot of handwork herself. She's an artist and so on and so forth. So we learn to live with each other's clutter. No problem. So one thing about, you know, the if you start making models and all that, you don't... I mean, you really naturally decide to cut out rubbish from your life. So I don't have a TV at home. I don't watch TV. Anyway, most of TV is meant for brain dead people. Only complete nonsense comes on TV. So I don't watch TV. Whatever I want to see about the outside world, whether it is on my hobbies or current affairs or anything, I watch YouTube whenever I want to. I'm not a member of a club. I don't try not to commute. And I don't have too many friends. Most of my friends are people in either my professional space, a few of them, and you know, people are interested in the same hobbies. So I push a 16-hour day, 7 days a week.
So this is really amazing. So my next question is, why do you do what you do, and what makes it all worth it? So basically, what inspires you? What keeps you going?
It's beauty. I say it's absolutely something about beauty. You see, I like the aesthetics of locomotives. And I think when something is mechanically perfect, it's also very beautiful. I cannot think of anything that is mechanically perfect which is not beautiful. If you take a good watch, a good clock, you know, a lathe, a good car, you know, aesthetics for me is important. So to me, just looking at something that's finished and knowing that every single thing on that finished product, you know it. Like for example, there are certain things on my locomotive models which nobody will see because it goes underneath. I have to turn it upside down and with a torch, I have to show you that the number of rivets on a particular fitting is exactly the same as in the original. Now that is something that only I know. And my models are extremely accurate. Even if I make it in cardboard, if there are 960 rivets on the tender, there will be 960 rivets on my tender also, because all riveted pieces. So every single part is replicated to the great deal of accuracy. That gives me a lot of pleasure, and it that is what inspires. The second thing recently, this is a recent thing, is that I used to go for drawings and so on and so forth. I was not very interested. It was tedious work. But after my visit to England last year, when I started collecting drawings, I found that I really enjoyed the research part of it. Because research is real mystery. I mean, I must tell you recently what happened. There's a locomotive that's lying in a park in Bangalore. Mm-hmm. Now, somebody put up a picture of that locomotive, and I get very frustrated when people put up pictures and then you ask them, what is it? And they say, it's a locomotive. I know it's a locomotive. Tell me what's the marking on it, how many wheels it has, nothing. They don't know anything. Mm-hmm. So nobody could identify this locomotive. It's in a park in Bangalore. So I said, okay. I went there. I took a look at a locomotive. The first thing that you do when you look at a locomotive in India is you measure the track dimension. Mm-hmm. Because the moment you measure the track dimension, you know whether it is meter gauge, narrow gauge, correct, or broad gauge. And then you confine your search only to that gauge, no? Mm-hmm. So when I measured it, I found that it is a 2 feet narrow gauge. Mm-hmm. I said, wow, 2 feet narrow gauge only runs in four places in the country. 2 feet narrow gauge runs in Darjeeling, in Mathiran, right? Actually, it runs only in 3 places in the country, because the Fata and all those in West Bengal, they shut down in the 1920s. Mm-hmm. So, 2 feet narrow gauge runs in Darjeeling, Mathiran and Gwalior. So, immediately I said, this is a Gwalior locomotive, because I know that by process of elimination, because I know all the locomotives that run on Darjeeling and Mathiran, I removed those, and this is a Gwalior locomotive. Wow. Then I started doing the research on that locomotive, and I found a picture of that locomotive when it was delivered in 1948. And so I put the whole thing together. This locomotive doesn't have a single marking on it. But with my research now, I have narrowed it down to say that this is either locomotive number XYZ or ABC, because only two models came. Right. So I've reached that stage. That kind of research, you know, like Sherlock Holmes, looking for the clues and so on and so forth. Then I did another thing. It was all repainted and painted and all that. And the paint was totally peeling. Very carefully, on the front cow catcher, I scraped off the paint and discovered underneath the number painted in Devanagari script. And I said, this is another proof that this is a Gwalior locomotive. So this pleasure, you know, you can't share it with anybody, because people don't understand the mental stimulation that you get by discovering clues and identifying something. One thing is the beauty of the finished product really inspires me. But now a new thing has happened, that discovering the history and the story behind some mysteries and mystery locomotives, that also inspires me.
That's really amazing. So now we are coming to the end of the podcast. So a couple of more questions. So what's next for you?
Next for me is to really concentrate on my goal of 4 models a year. I have to make my workspace more efficient. My aim is to build 150 locomotive models. That will make me, I mean, the biggest model maker in India. Mm-hmm. Wow. And definitely that is something that I am looking forward to.
This is really amazing and inspiring. I know you already talked about process of documenting things for Indian makers. But apart from that, what is your advice for fellow Indian makers?
Just do it. Just get down and do it. Stop talking. A lot of people, they talk a lot. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, just get down and do it. Just, you know, for model making, for people who are making models, for example, they tell me, you know, how do I start? I'd say go and measure a wheel from whichever locomotive you want and make that wheel. Mm-hmm. Make one wheel. Okay, that's it. You can't, there's no theory in this. You go and make that one thing, then that's what you'll do. That's what gets you started. Second thing is, please document what you're doing. This is something that we guys in India don't do well. And when I say document, document to the nth degree of detail. Document everything. Document your successes. Document your mistakes. Document something that you will do better next time. And document the sequence. Document the process. Do it through video, whatever it is your thing, and put it out. And of course, the third thing is never, don't listen to too many people. Follow what's in your head. And don't take too much of advice from people, because advice is all based on proven wisdom, you know. And a lot of the makers succeed in the because of unconventional wisdom. So today's proven wisdom doesn't mean that that's the end of wisdom. Some new thing comes and that will just wipe out old wisdom. So you just don't have to think too much about other people. Listen to what they say, but do your own thing. That's what I like to advise. Yeah,
that's great. So one final question before we end the podcast. So this, again, this is a ritual of this podcast. Who is someone you would like to see next in Maker Stories?
Oh, there is a gentleman called Iqbal Ahmad. He has been covered in the past by various forums, but I don't think he's been covered by, you know, he's not considered a maker in that way, in that fashion. But he is based out of Nagpur, I think. Mm-hmm. And he manufactures the most, he's a master craftsman on the lathe. Mm-hmm. And without 3D drawings, without 3D printing, without any of the, you know, equipment that we guys used, he makes the most exquisite steam locomotive models and engine models. You know, he has built the world's smallest functioning steam engine. That steam engine, the stationary engine, can sit on your fingernail. That's the quality of this. He must be quite old. He must be 70 plus. But he is just way beyond amazing. You know, Indian, see, young people, you'll find a lot of people and they have a lot of tools. As I said, the tools opens up the space and allows you to do fantastic things. I'm not belittling anybody because, you know, every generation has its tools, right?
Correct.
But Mr. Iqbal Ahmad is a master craftsman. I mean, in fact, there's a website called Craftsmanship Museum. And if you go there, you will see his work there. Your jaw will drop at the kind of quality that he produces. Miniature models of locomotives, of stationary steam engines, of automotive engines, of machine tools. He's made tiny lathes, like 3 inches long, complete model of a full-scale lathe in 3 inches. It works. He's amazing.
Mm-hmm. All right, definitely. I will be in touch for his contact. So is there anything else that you would like to share with the community?
No, I just, well, I just want to thank you for covering me because, you know, you, as a maker, you generally feel a bit lonely because you're doing something on your own. But it's great to be part of a community, and I look forward to this community being built up by you and more sharing of expertise and skills. So I really wish you all the best, and I wish all makers out there all luck and great happiness.
All right. Thanks, Raghunandan. So it was really amazing and inspiring. See, even with your professional job, the amount of time that you are spending with building these railway locomotive models and some of the things that you are planning to do in the over the next few years. So thanks for sharing your story.
Thank you, Samar. Thank you. It was a privilege speaking to you. Thank you very much.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, request you to share it within your social network. You can share your review and comments to us via email makerstories@outlook.com. I will be back with more maker stories in next episode. Until then, happy making.
Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.